Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Okay, welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you can join us. And as usual, I want to mention that just because you hear something interesting on the show today, you think it might be a good strategy for yourself to deploy, please don't run out and do so without first checking with your advisors that are aware of your current facts and circumstances when it comes to tax issues, legal issues, retirement planning issues, and real estate issues. Are you savvy to understanding how private placement memorandums are put together? Do you understand what an operating agreement is, how to assess various terms and conditions on what you're signing up for if you join that partnership? You know, all the things that you need to be aware of before you give someone you don't know, you know, 50 or 100,000 or more of your hard-earned money. And that's what we do with our client base primarily, is we're working with people that are investing in real estate, private partnership syndications, or they're headed to retirement here in the next near-term period of time. They're trying to get their affairs in order for what are going to be very difficult years in 2029 to 2030, when the government essentially has spent the rest of the discretionary budget component that is dwindling. The way our group in Washington, our Congress people, like to spend money. And so check with your advisors. If you don't have advisors, feel free to connect with us. You can go to our website at beaplanner.com. That's BEAPLANNER. .com. And if you'll notice there at the top right, I've got two links that you'll want to visit. The forms link, which takes you to a page with four steps or four forms. If you would be so kind as to fill out step one, at least the client profile, and then we'd love it if you have significant retirement savings or wealth, we'd love it if you would go ahead and fill out step two. And then step three would give us the ability to understand what you're about tax-wise, and we would be able to discuss specific issues with you. We'll be able to assess whether we know of strategies that fit your facts and circumstances, and etc. And then once you've filled out the forms, go to the call link at the very top right and schedule a call. And I and or Dan Dubose, or both of us, will be happy to discuss how we might be able to sync up with your facts and circumstances to help you meet your objectives. And speaking of Mr. Dan Dubose, he is not joining me today. He's up in the deep, as he says, the deep East Texas. I don't want to get this wrong here. Hang on just a second. Let me look at his advice this morning. Deep East Texas is how he calls it. So he's en route. May be there by now, and he is celebrating the Sabine County Milam Settlers Day. I have no idea what that is, but I'm sure it's going to be a good time for all. But in any event, Dan, we hope you have a great Friday with your family. Okay, speaking of 2029 to 30, we're going to talk about that U.S. debt clock again. I've actually added it as a pinned item on our BAPlannerShow.com site. That's the companion site where we put, among other things, articles that we discuss on the air. And you'll notice at the top, I've got three pinned links in blue, and one of them is the U.S. debt clock. And I've been referring to this a lot lately just because the more you look at this thing, when you go to that website, it's that page is chock full of information, and it's only once you, you know, nose around on it for a while, you'll realize just how much is there. And you'll realize they've got a mobile app, which I'm not sure how they get all this on the mobile app. I try not to look at the mobile app because the size of any of my iPhone screens just really challenges my vision, whereas on the desktop I can quickly zoom that window. But it's remarkable the real-time calculators that are on this site. It's not just the U.S. federal or national level. You can click a link at the top to see assorted state debt clocks. And I say assorted, it looks like it may be all the states. In fact, I don't know. I haven't counted them. I guess it doesn't have enough abbreviations going across the screen there. But it's got a lot of them. And then it's got the world debt clocks. If you want to see how our fiscal situation compares to China, or Japan, other nations, that's an interesting view. And then the really neat tool, and I haven't talked about this on the air because you'll never stop, it has a time machine where you can roll back the information on your screen for all these assorted calculations back in time, all the way back to 1980. And boy, it's interesting. It's like we are going downhill, and I mean fast, just from 2020 to 2023. It doesn't have every year, but that's the most recent progression. And I tell you what, the only reason I keep referring to this, and I'm going to keep referring to it, for those of you that might not like to dwell on this, you need to dwell on it. And if it bothers you, what that tells me is you're not prepared. You've got maybe, $1 million, $2 million in a retirement account, gross, but that's not what you're going to have net. And you can even skip ahead to 2027 when you're going to have the beginning of what U.S. DebtClock.org refers to as the budget showdown. That's when it's probably going to start. It's 2029 to 30 when the bloodletting has really started, where we can't pay all the interest on the debt. And that's going to make it hard for a country like ours that's been able just to print money in the past, or print treasury bonds that we sell for money. And when you can't guarantee that you're going to pay 100% of the interest on the debt, which that's the position we're going to be in, let's see how many T-bills or how many treasury bonds we can sell. It's going to be a problem. And in any event, I just find this real-time calculator just phenomenal, and so many different pieces of information. Not just what's our U.S. national debt. It's got the debt per citizen, the debt per taxpayer, which this is just on the $33 trillion or $33.7 trillion that we actually put on the nation's balance sheet. That works out to $103 per taxpayer. That's your share of the debt, my share of the debt, et cetera. And that's just the debt that we admit to. If you look at the unfunded liability, which is further down the page here, let's see. Well, I'm struggling to find that. I've looked at it in the recent past. I want to say it's somewhere. Well, it depends on which assumption set you use. Some people say the unfunded liability puts our total outstanding debt up to as much as $250 trillion. Others say it's $150, $160. In any event, that works out to, I don't know, it's somewhere in the $700,000 or $800,000 range per taxpayer, which is just absolutely, absolutely crazy. But in any event, I'm going to leave this pinned. You really ought to consider putting it on your phone. It's, you know, when you're waiting in line at the whatever, post office, bank, et cetera. Although I don't know, it's kind of depressing. You may not want to look at this, but I think the more people we get to look at this and they understand the severity of what we're facing, you know, maybe we can put some pressure on the folks in Washington to, you know, implement some mitigating policies. And I hate to say it, but, you know, folks, one of two things has to happen. Either the tax rates have to go up or GDP has to go up substantially. Higher productivity would be one solution that if you could generate enough additional GDP, that increases the tax revenues that the government takes in. And, of course, it presumes that Congress won't go spend it all and that we actually can reduce the debt. But, you know, it's unlikely, you know, with the group we have in Congress. But you don't have to be a mathematician to understand just how bad it is. I noticed that I found my number on the U.S. total debt. The total debt that they use on this side, again, their assumptions are different than some of the other forecasts I've seen. CountinginTruth.org would be another site you may want to mention. But anyway, they use $103 trillion. On this site. So, you know, if you boiled that down to each taxpayer, that's going to land you somewhere in that $800,000 number. But that's just absolutely crazy that we've gone from, well, you can look here on this site, you can go back 2008, 2004, 1980, and it's crazy how all of this, or most of this, has occurred in the recent past. And we're going to have a day of reckoning. And, you know, when you get to retirement and you start taking money out of your 401 and realize, you know what, I'm paying more tax now than I did when I was working, that's when it's going to hit you. And then, worse, when you realize, well, wait a minute, I thought I had $1 million, but the tax brackets have gone up. CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, almost 15 years ago, issued a study that said we needed to raise the brackets by 150%. That was back in 2009 when I think we were at 70% of GDP. In terms of the outstanding debt. Now we're at, well, again, it depends on which set of assumptions. I believe this site, and that's the only problem with this site, man. You got to bookmark your space to try to get back to certain numbers, but the number they have here, well, and they even show the progression here, which is kind of interesting. They show now we're 124% of GDP. I think that's low. I think their assumptions are a little bit too conservative or maybe too liberal. I've seen other economists say that, you know, we're at as much as 150, maybe 130. But more telling is that in the year 2000, we were only at 55%. You go back to 1980, we were 34%. And I guess to give us hope, in 1960, the year I was born, it was at 52%. And I think it may have, I've read the history before, and I can't remember which periods of time were related to war funding, you know, we printed money or sell bonds to fund assorted wars. That we've never seen that now here lately, have we? We don't know what that's like. And that could be the issue that causes a faster succession or a faster path to running out of the or spending the rest of the fiscal budget. In any event, we'll continue with more of the Be a Planner show in a few minutes. Or yes, we're going to go ahead and take our first break. There's the music, and we'll be right back with the Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Well, I'm not the Dalai Lama, but I'll try to offer up a few words of advice. You better get to living, giving. Don't forget to throw in a little forgiveness.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195. 713-581-0195. Or you can send an email to Nathan@npross.com. Nathan@npross.com.
Have you recently joined a real estate mentor program? BeAPlanner.com shows how real estate investments combined with proactive tax planning can generate significant wealth. However, syndication terms for private real estate partnerships are complicated. They help you assess the benefits of ownership from A acquisition to E exit. A planner wants to know what they are signing up for. BeAPlanner.com with CPA Nathan Ross. BeAPlanner.com.
Dreams and fantasies, and there are many just like me with big dreams and fantasies.
Okay, welcome back to more of the Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And before I get off this U.S. debt clock site, I want to mention one of the links that's on it where you can see a depiction of how CBO scores the numbers and versus the Office of Management and Budget versus the U.S. debt clock. And you can go to that link that calculates on this day in 2027. So on the, let's see, 17th of November, what is our national debt going to look like? What's our interest going to look like? What's our deficit going to look like for, I guess, that year? And it's pretty startling. Just at a high level, the U.S. national debt, according to CBO, and this was all updated fairly recently. The CBO issued revised numbers. I think it's been about a month ago now. Anyway, they say that by the 17th of November, it'll be $39.5 trillion, and that's up from today. It's 33. Now I don't know about the likelihood of that, because you know we're already at, we were 1.7 trillion, I believe it was, for fiscal year 23 that just ended. I believe it was end of September. And I think we're already at 1.6 trillion for the current year. So I don't know. I guess that might get you there if you had four more years of similar numbers, but I'm not sure how much we've added in for, you know, the ongoing war in Ukraine, our Israel financial support, what I think is going to be our Taiwan financial support any day. I just don't see that problem going away based on what I read in the media. I'm certainly no China or Taiwan expert, although I've flown through both countries. But in any event, the amount of interest that we'll be paying that year, CBO projects to be $912 billion, so just under a trillion. OMB puts our debt at $40.5 trillion, so they're about a trillion higher on their estimates. And then, let's see, the net interest on the debt, they've got, OMB shows it at $935 billion, so a little bit higher. But the U.S. debt clock site, the site we're on, they calculate the interest on the debt at the current rates that we're paying, which they're saying we don't see hope necessarily that rates go down on the debt, you know, as we renew it. You want to know what we'll be paying at that point if you're not looking at this site? $3,083 billion, almost a half or $500 million. So $3,083,477,000+ a year. That's crazy. Now that assumes we don't issue new treasury bonds at lower rates, and I would tell you the reason this analysis may be more nearly correct than, you know, CBO or OMB is because it's going to get more expensive to borrow the closer we get to the period where we can't guarantee 100% of the interest on the debt gets paid. And again, that looks like it's going to be 2029 or 30. It may be sooner. And I'm going to keep harping on that because if you're in the camp that has yet to do any Roth conversion of your pre-tax money, you need to take advantage of several things. One is the ability to do it. You can do it no matter how much money you make. You can do Roth conversions. Secondly is the current tax rates. Even if you're in the top bracket, you need to consider that they're on sale compared to what they're going to be. And again, CBO suggested raising all the tax rates or tax brackets by 150% back 14 years ago, almost 15 years ago. So now, by most economists' estimates, that amount of raising the brackets would need to be closer to 200%. So I know 37% plus, I say plus because of the net investment income tax, or Obamacare tax, we call it. I know that's a lot of tax, but it's going to be much, much higher if we're going to avoid default. And, of course, there's a lot of ifs there. We don't know but what GDP may go up. We don't know how much of this tax burden would be shared between corporate and personal. But I'll just tell you, it's such a massive number, it really doesn't matter. The brackets have to go up significantly. So if you're sitting here now with the dollars in pre-tax accounts, you really need to consider starting the process. You don't have to do it all in 1 year. You can do a portion of it each year. You've got until 1/1/2026 before the brackets reset to where they were before the 2017 jobs cut and let me look here. Well, yeah, 1/1/2026 before the Trump 2017 Tax Act, and that's going to catch, depending on where your income is, that's going to change potentially more than a little bit the tax you would pay. So you really want to look at this carefully and make sure that you're not just over the line and start the process, so that when we get there, your major income streams are in Roth type accounts. Let's see. Let's look at some of the other current news. There's an article that, since we're talking about deficits and current economic issues, I've got an article called Hard Landing, Soft Landing. These economists say there will be no landing at all. So this is, once again, where economists differ. And this is a Philadelphia Fed office survey where the general consensus has been one of two camps the economists land in, and the Fed themselves obviously debates this issue. I believe it's monthly, right? Or quarterly? Monthly, I believe. And some prefer a soft landing, where the economy slows gradually, touching down with unemployment remaining moderate and no recession, versus the other camp that are in the hard landing group think that there will be some significant disruption in the economy that causes higher unemployment and disrupts economic activity. But it's now becoming realized or known that some economists, they're saying, hey, we see signs that are going on both sides of this argument. We really think the answer to this question may be up in the air for quite some time. And I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing. I suspect most business people would like to see something definitive. On the other hand, depends on what kind of transactions you're trying to undertake and how it would impact a particular class of real estate. Maybe office, commercial real estate, and the office class has just been decimated with the recent past, the interest rates predominantly, and yet multifamily is still strong, although it's stronger in some areas than others. And I've got another article we'll talk about here in a minute regarding that. But, you know, I find it interesting that even the experts are no better than you and I in projecting what's going to happen. And if anything, we're probably closer to the flame. I mean, how many people have purchased a piece of real estate lately and you've dealt with the inability or the difficulty in getting a loan? You know, the lenders have circled the wagons, and the ones that will lend money are driving a hard bargain on escrows. They want money in your escrow to cover additional rate increases, and they're not wanting to get locked down on, you know, fixed debt. And you know, what I see happening is, and I've got another article out here today, the second article or third article on the list, playing with the house's money, how buyers and sellers are closing deals. And we might as well go ahead and I was just looking at this article we were talking about. I wanted to just mention one quote. Forecasters now predict a mid 30% to a near 40% chance of a contraction in real GDP in any one of the four quarters in 2024. That could be problematic, obviously, right? But in any event, this would be something that we'll continue to monitor and stay in touch with what's going on in the market, because this, you know, it's a combination of all these factors. And in fact, the articles I put up today, I mean, they are on all sides of this issue. It kind of shows you why it's hard. In fact, that's the second article I've got on the list, is why real estate is so difficult to price right now. Well, these are some of the issues, and they're in the broader economy, but they affect, you know, if you're the one getting ready to sign your name on a loan or on a check, you know, this is critical knowledge. You know, what's going to happen in the economy? But going back to the article I just alluded to, playing with the house's money, let's see, here it is. Just trying to remember where I had that article. I know this is an issue. Personally, I'm experiencing this. I've got some properties for sale, and I've told my realtor, hey, for me, owner finance is not a plan B. How about we lead with that? You know, have you seen what mortgage rates are lately? I mean, I'm not, I would suggest to you, I'd be happy to be on, you know, as long as I've got first lien position, which I would, I'd be happy to sell as long as I can get my price. I'll give you owner financing, sure. You know, 20 to 30% down payment, 8 to 10% rates, variable. Yeah, we'll do that. We'll approve you. No worries. And that's how a lot of people are buying real estate. That, you know, some people refer to it as creative finance. Well, it's owner financing. Been around forever. And, you know, owners that have the ability to get their number, and particularly in the case where they control the lien, you know, they would suggest they're probably better off getting a sure 8 to 10% on their money without, you know, having to, you know, be locked out of the property transaction. Meaning, you know, they've still got first lien. They got a chunk up front. I mean, that'd be a great, quote, used car lot, end quote, to have. You know, better than any make and model of automobile I can think of. If I can take that house or that property back, that's a great deal. But anyway, if you look at what's going on, even in the multifamily game, you know, the way that, you know, the big players are finding a way to make things work is, you know, sellers are now willing to work with buyers in the form of some short-term seller financing. And that's what's getting transactions done. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, effectively it's a seller form of bridge loan. And, you know, they can charge, according to this article, they're getting rates of, say, 5% versus maybe 8% with the traditional lender. So it's helpful for the buyer to move forward, push forward, and get the deal done. But in any event, speaking of the article as to why real estate is so hard to price right now. Hey, I tell you what, let's go ahead and take our last break. We'll come back and pick up with this article. There's a couple points here that I want to mention, and we'll be right back with more of the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
I was gonna be rich no matter how much it cost, and I was gonna win no matter how much I lost. Grindstones and rhinestones have made up my life, but I shine like a diamond through sacrifice. I was gonna be rich no matter how much it cost, and I was gonna win no matter how much I lost. But I hope that you'll tell me, well done my child, you've won your reward through your sacrifice. Your sacrifice.
Did you know 76% of Americans are concerned they won't have a secure retirement? BeAPlanner.com shows how private real estate partnerships can increase current cash flow and retirement savings. There are three options to control your 401 and IRAs, but only one will double your retirement lifestyle. BeAPlanner.com for the Be a Planner Show with CPA Nathan Ross.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to nathan@npross.com, nathan@npross.com.
Have you recently joined a real estate mentor program? BeAPlanner.com shows how real estate investments combined with proactive tax planning can generate significant wealth. However, syndication terms for private real estate partnerships are complicated. They help you assess the benefits of ownership from A acquisition to E exit. A planner wants to know what they are signing up for. BeAPlanner.com with CPA Nathan Ross. BeAPlanner.com.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control.
Okay, welcome back to the final segment of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we were just getting ready to talk about an article that's towards the top of the list. It was just out, what, 2 days ago, or yesterday, on the realdeal.com site, which that's a very good site for keeping up with news around the country and all facets of real estate, but they'll have, you know, local Texas information, Arizona information, California, et cetera, all the major metros. And then they also will do some investigative studies, on who's, which syndicator is in trouble, which loans are on the watch list, et cetera. And so they tend to cause some consternation among the syndicator crowd. But, you know, it's kind of a good thing. It lets us understand, yeah, we're on the outside looking in, just trying to help our clients ascertain who they should invest with. And, you know, it's nice to see someone that's got enough leverage. You know, a syndicator may or may not return their phone call, but you can rest assured once the article shows up, they'll be wanting to correct it if it's wrong. So in any event, but what I wanted to point out here, there were a couple things in this article that, you know, there's a reference to how weak the office market has gotten. New York City office sales are down nearly 50% from last year. That kind of sets the tone. But, you know, how do you price a half-empty office tower in Manhattan's garment district? Or how about an aging apartment complex in a Phoenix suburb? I mean, these are the difficulties right now. Nobody has a good sense of value. And I guess the historical valuations maybe aren't quite as reliable. And, you know, valuation is thought of as a dark art. Seen several books over the years refer to that. It's like, well, you're seeing right now, look at President Trump's trial in New York. There's dark art valuation right there. Look at the different experts that are testifying as to the value. There's no two of them that are coming up with the same numbers, right? Because they're different uses of valuation data. And, you know, you could easily justify a higher number or justify a lower number. It depends on what's the circumstances. Are you valuing something for an insurance policy? Are you valuing it for property taxes? Are you valuing it to try to sell it? You know, there's a number of ways to value real estate, and this article right here is exhibit one on, you know, why there's a difference in value. But with the higher interest rates having led to fewer transactions, that leaves less data for appraisers to reference. And it makes, as I say here, it obscures an already murky view for brokers, lenders, and developers. And you know, it'll be interesting to see how that trial ends up. I just don't see, you know, how, I mean, again, when you fill out loan applications and insurance applications, there's always, always a disclaimer that, you know, these amounts, these values are, you know, the borrower's representations. But you as a lender, you as an insurer, you as a whatever, got to do your own due diligence. And obviously in Trump's case, the banks made the loans. Banks aren't that easy to get loans from. May have been easier during the period he did it. But, you know, I don't understand how you can say fraud. Fraud would be if you were trying, you would put disclaimers, you know, on the first page of every, maybe every page. I don't know. I haven't watched some of those details that carefully. But in any event, there was a comment in this article that the net result of the valuations not being clear is that deal makers are avoiding office spaces and instead looking at more stable asset classes such as top-of-the-line apartment buildings and warehouses where valuations are clearer. And why is that? Because lenders are focusing on math metrics outside of valuations. We focus on cash flow, is what they quote a gentleman that heads commercial real estate for one of the banks in New York, New Jersey. And, you know, cash flow is, in the apartment game, cash flow is the game. And that's the way, you know, we can invest in older buildings, you know, rehab them to a current market standard of the amenity type, etc., make them nice, and rent them at higher rates, generates higher cash flow, higher NOI, and that attracts more money on either a refinance or a sell. And it's magical. If you don't understand the way that that process works and you're only thinking from the perspective of your single family rental property, where literally on a single family rental, I don't care how well you operate it, how lucrative it is, you're constrained. Your sales price is capped by what your neighbor three blocks over sold their house for last week or last month or whatever, per square foot. And so, you know, that's not relevant in the apartment game. What is relevant is what's your net operating income. So, you know, the resulting increase in your rental top line growth that creates a increase lower line growth of net operating income, that's what matters. And so that's how you don't have to be buying the Class A apartment buildings to be successful and to make money in the multifamily game. It's just magic the way a good operator is able to take those old buildings and understand what level of amenity you need to provide to get the maximum throughput out of those enhancements. And you got to know what to spend money on. And that's where, you know, if you're a member of one of the mentor platforms, you talk to other partners that are leading these transactions, you get to know people, and hopefully you'll have a resource you can connect with. And when, if you're the lead partner and you buy an older building and it's got a decrepit swimming pool or landscaping's in bad shape, you've got others that own properties in the general area where you can ask them, hey, do I cement that pool in, or do I beautify it and, you know, make sure it's got the requisite safety code being met, so that you don't end up on local news stations with problems later. And you might also inquire as to, well, what's the move-in special that seems to be successful, or what's the appropriate policy on landscaping? I mean, there's obviously a limit on how much you can justify, and given properties, given locations, et cetera, but I would suggest that location, location, location especially is appropriate. Properties in better locations tend to appreciate further. They also stay better occupied at higher rates. And, you know, I think in large measure I've watched, you know, reviewed, invested, et cetera, in these transactions now for over 20 years. And I would tell you, I'll take a good location over a bad location, even if on the surface it doesn't appear that would be as lucrative, because it's got less risk. And when you're investing your retirement funds or other funds, you don't want to expose it to any more risk than you need to. I had referenced earlier a article, the two factors that drive regional multifamily differences. Let's see here. Here we go. Because, you know, we talk in these, a lot of these articles are at a national vantage point, and they kind of overlook the fact that within every average, there's, you know, half the group is above the average, half the group is likely below the average, And as the subtitle says here on this article, two factors that drive regional multifamily differences. Year-to-date revenue per unit growth ranged from 5.2% to minus 3.6%, while vacancy rates varied from minus 0.1% to plus 0.5%. So there's, you know, when you're talking about a 500, 400, et cetera, unit apartment building, those are conceivably some, you know, big differences. But in any event, you know, this is an interesting read, and it's got a lot of statistical data, so I'm not going to get down into the weeds, but it'd be worth reading. If you go to the website, again, it's beaplannershow.com. Go to the resources link, and, you know, the vacancy rates are, like, the biggest issue as opposed to rent growth. The effect of rent growth is obviously could be an issue and is in some cases, but you know, they point out that the Southwest region had the strongest effective rental growth. However, its performance was hindered by a vacancy rate that increased the most. So, you know, you've got a yin and a yang here, I guess. And it's interesting to get some perspective. If you're looking to invest, you'd like to be aware of which of the top metros are clicking on both cylinders here versus, you know, occupancy or higher rental growth rate. And I would tend to say the higher occupancy is probably the way I would proceed, although again, you'd have to give me a specific area and specific property, what class property is it, et cetera. I would tell you that the higher the class rating, longer term, the better off you may be, although again, depends on what's going on in that market, and there's nothing wrong at all. The most money will be made typically by buying a beat up old Class C apartment building, rehabbing it to a current market standard, which will get the market rents up, or the rental rates of that complex up to the market rate, and effectively raise NOI, assuming your occupancy follows those improvements. And typically, people want to live, obviously, in nicer, newer surroundings, and you know, with the new amenities, you know, the BART park and other issues that come with stainless appliances, new flooring, etc. Oh, we're right at the end of the show. Timed it beautifully. Thank you so much, and we'll be back here in a couple days on Sunday morning, 7 a.m. right here on AM 700 KSEV.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.